This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Public schools across the state began a new year this morning, and many students kicked off a new term at home. As the pandemic wears on, some administrators have made the difficult decision to continue the remote instruction that they started in March. And of course, that has required schools to overhaul the way the school day is constructed. But if there's any administrator who's up to that task, it is Tabari Wallace. Tabari is principal of West Craven High School, where he made national headlines last spring by bringing individual pre-graduation parades to each of his seniors' doorsteps. That school is in Vanceboro. It's a small town in eastern North Carolina, and Tabari Wallace joins us today. Welcome to the State of Things.
How you doing? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing fine, but the first day of school doesn't mean to me what it does to you. You're inside the principal's office right now at West Craven. What's that first day of school like?
Oh, it definitely started off with great anticipation, and then you always know something is going to go a little sly on the first day every time. Statewide, we had a system failure in regards to my NC Ed Cloud, but they got it straight, they got it fixed, and we're back online now, we're ready to go.
That had to create a moment of panic for just about everybody, did it?
Oh, teachers and students as well, because we're doing our head count. So second period is where we want to make sure we enlist and get our attendance records straight so we can send it on up the ladder. And we had kids calling saying they can't get on due to they couldn't log into their Ed Cloud. So
right.
Definitely that. So we're going to readjust and attempt tomorrow. So.
Wow. Well, it's got to be so weird because, you know, this is not your first day of school, but unlike the, you know, panicked calls from lost bus drivers, this is a completely different experience, isn't it?
Extremely different because you always see the bright eye. You see the new school clothes, and, you know, when the traditional return to school, and you see the bright-eyed faces that you hadn't seen. And then I walked in this morning when all their teachers went into their classrooms, and it was just very, very quiet, very sullen, it's almost like the tumbleweeds in the westerns where you see the little thing roll across and nobody's around. So it's a lonely principal I was this morning. But as soon as the kids got online, we returned to prominence. So.
Well, I want to talk more about that and, of course, what the last 6 months have been. But I want to figure out how you got where you are and talk about your trajectory and your life journey that brought you to this place right now. Because I know that when you were in high school, being an educator was perhaps about the last thing on your mind. What were you thinking as you were leaving high school?
Well, everybody, I mean, every child, especially where you come from, where I'm from, and you have somewhat great talents that, in your own mind, you always think you can make it to be, you know, a professional this or professional that. So, you know, I always thought that I would, you know, excel at the professional ranks and be doing something different. And my first, actually, degree is not in education at all. It's in physical and cognitive rehabilitation. So definitely education was not my first choice coming in.
You were hoping to play football, right?
Yeah, I was. And, you know, went to East Carolina and played some ball and got a little look. A lot of looks while I was at East Carolina, but, you know, did not think of education at the time.
Well, interestingly enough, you didn't get a lot of looks. You were a good player, an awfully good player in high school, and yet got overlooked by the scouts. Maybe overshadowed is the word. You were playing around some other top-tier players as well, right?
Yeah, I had the likes of Jeremy McDaniel, who went on to play for the Buffalo Bills, Brian Simmons, who had a long career at Cincinnati Bengals, Stacy Whitehead, who, you know, went up to Canada and played arena ball as well, like me. But, you know, we had some troopers on that team, that 93 team that came out of New Bern High School, and they were all looking at those three and two others. Steve Fisher was on that team. And, you know, I just think I got lucky. I think somebody had a plan for me to get me to East Carolina, even though I went the side route, the walk-on route.
Well, you walked on, and about 2 years later, you had yourself an athletic scholarship. So they saw something once you got there, right?
Oh, yes. The road less traveled. This is what I usually try to tell people. I took the road less traveled to get to where I was at. But, you know, thanks, hats off to East Carolina University. You know, they gave me a chance. And then, you know, I showed them what I had, and then, you know, two years later, I had a scholarship, you know, and kudos to Steve Logan. He really takes care of his athletes. If you work hard, you can attain anything is his motto.
Well, let's take you back even farther, because you were a military brat and actually born in Puerto Rico. Your father was in the Navy. How long have you lived in North Carolina?
Been in North Carolina since we got here right after I started school, right there, I would say 7 or 8. Right in that range, but, you know, we moved from Puerto Rico to South Carolina, Then we got to North Carolina. So I called North Carolina home because we didn't move anymore once we got here. My father went up to Norfolk, and he kept driving back and forth every other week. So during my speeches, I tell them, yeah, I had a father, but in the Navy and he's deployed or they're not here, you don't get to see him but every other weekend. So it was tough coming up, humble beginnings, I can say.
And your family settled in New Bern when you're here in North Carolina in the Five Points area. So what was life like growing up there?
You just had to be tough. You had to be tough, and you had to know the rules of your neighborhood, if you get what I'm saying. We were right in front of Craven Terrace, which is a very well-known project right here in Craven County. And then we thought we moved up. We thought we were the Jeffersons, and we moved up. But we moved from over there and moved into Duffy Field. And Duffy Field pretty much is still Five Points. I guess it's the suburbia of the projects, if a lot of people would call it. But it was tough. You had to know how to use your hands. You had to know certain rules to follow, keep to yourself, and it was just tough. It was just a tough upbringing.
But through all of that, you described your teachers as very invested in your success. Talk about your public school experiences.
Yes, I was fortunate enough to have some great teachers coming up, some from right from the area that I was living, which was great. And when I came up, it was a different time. You know, kids, we didn't have all the rights that students have right now. When the teacher picked up the phone, you were already in trouble before the teacher finished the sentence with your parents, because education was a way to get us out of the predicament that we were currently in at that time. And the teachers knew that. The only way we were going to be able to change our reality was to get educated and then go make something of yourself when you get older. So I can say a lot of people teach to the middle and then let the chips fall where they may, but some teachers invest in their children. They give something of themselves, time, resources, love, caring. And once you give a part of yourself to a child, that child usually takes it, and the return on your investment is usually more meaningful than you just teaching to the middle.
It's interesting that you've taken that experience that you had, sort of embodied it when you were an elementary school student, and are clearly applying that to what you're doing now. And again, we're going to talk more about how you applied what you sort of assimilated going through public schools to what you're doing now. But, and you did get interested in football. You were playing Pop Warner at the time, right? And then played high school football, as you said.
Yep.
And then it's interesting because you talked about, you got that scholarship eventually at ECU. So what were you thinking afterward in terms of your pro prospects?
Sky was the limit then. You know, I had an agent and we were going, and Pittsburgh was heavy, actually was in a couple of camps with them. And, it was looking promising. And then draft day comes, and, the only phone call you got is a possible camp invite from Pittsburgh. You see what I'm saying? So it's just one of those deals where, just got to keep chugging. And then when that didn't pan out, you go back to school, and then you begin to get your master's. And then the phone ring with the arena opportunity. So,
yeah, and you played arena football. But meanwhile, there's the love of your life at this moment. And apart from being an underdog on a football team, which you'd always sort of worked through, you also met another major challenge, and that was back in high school, because you found out you were expecting a child, and that was in high school, right?
Yes, that was in high school. My junior year is when she was conceived, and she came out my senior year in high school. And that was that's a life-changing moment right there when that happened. And once you got a little mouth to feed and them little eyes that stand up to you is dependent on you to make it, then it kind of changes things and puts life in a totally different perspective than your little kid that's just running around and just living life day by day, just seeing what fun you could get into. That was definitely a life-changing moment. So glad I got her. Still got her, And yeah. Me and Mom are still married today. So.
Well, but I wonder, at that time, again, you've got these expectations. You're thinking about maybe getting into to play some college ball. You're thinking, still thinking about the pros. How did that change your outlook or your sense of what you could do in that moment when you were going to be committed to this new life, and yet you had your whole life ahead of you?
Yeah, it changed things, because you can't take the risk as you normally would if it's just you. If you shoot for the stars and you fall, then it's just you have to worry about. You fall on hard times. But me making the wrong decision on the way I wanted, to proceed in life was now affecting a little one, and it puts it in perspective. A case in point, jump a little ahead in what we are going to talk about, but When I was playing arena ball, I was able to leave work, which is schooling, because they play it in the spring. I could take a leave of absence and still be able to do both. But, you know, comes a time where you have to choose the career or the dream because you got a little mouth to feed, you know, in the back. You can't keep jumping back and forth. And I'm just glad I chose the career because, you know,
fast forward
a couple of years, look where we are today.
Talking about your trajectory, let's get a little deeper into your college life because at East Carolina you earned your bachelor's degree in physical rehabilitation. So what led you to choose that as your major?
You know, that it was a weird decision. I was dilly-dallying in the allied health fields, you know, when you're trying to find yourself your first 2 years. And we just landed there. It's the weirdest thing. I liked working along, you know, side, you know, a lot of the doctors and the paraprofessionals. And I did an intern at Pitt Memorial Hospital under Cheryl Gentile. And it was just the most rewarding experience. And I think I got bit by the bug then by going in to help and assist people during their time of need.
You were playing football. We talked a little bit about that. Tell us about your experience. You played defensive back for the Pirates, right, from 94 to 97. What are some of your proudest moments as a player?
I can say definitely getting the touchdown at the end to seal the game for Miami was a big one. When we went down, nobody gave us a chance to go down and beat them down there in their in the Orange Bowl on their turf. You know, at that time, Miami was on this winning streak, and they had just lost for the first time in like years the week before we got down there. Then we turned around and beat them again. So that was beautiful how that happened, and I just happened to catch that interception that sealed the game and took it down. That was just a great time.
I was going to say, just for a defensive back to be able to score, that's a big deal all by itself. But again, when the stakes are that high, very cool.
Exactly. And a little not known fact, right before our first Liberty Bowl spurt, you know, this little redshirt freshman, I was wearing number 46 at the time. That's just to put it in perspective for you of how it was. Still a walk-on, hadn't earned a scholarship yet. All the starters had went down. I mean, five players were either hurt or went down. The Hart twins, E-Mac, everybody was hurt. And then they had to throw old Snoop in. They called me Snoop in college. And they said, Snoop, get in there. And I'm wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, sitting there like, what in the world is going on? But natural instincts just took over. And they threw the ball, I intercepted it, and sealed the game that time, and we went on. That made us eligible to go to the Liberty Bowl, and that was the beginning. That was the creation of Snoop, as Jeff Charles loves to say, Tabari Snoop Wallace. That's when I landed, buddy, and then they gave me a scholarship that summer. They said, this boy can play. Let's keep him.
There you go. So now you're well on your way, and you're thinking, okay, maybe I've got some pro prospects. And you tried out Pittsburgh, right? You've tried out for the Steelers?
Yep, I did. Trying to make that, people don't understand, trying to make a pro roster, buddy, is extremely difficult. Just trying to get the look is difficult. But coming out of camp, you know, they run you on the pro time and day, and then, you know, the scouts are around, and, you know, they see talent, and they look for talent to see if they can develop it. So I had that tryout, it was in camp, and, you know, didn't pan out. So then we went on, I came back to school and started working on my master's in rehabilitation. And then that's when the Arena League called, and then the rest is history.
We'll talk about that. Where'd you play, and what was that like?
Okay, we was with the Houston Thunder Bears. If a lot of people, true arena heads, will remember, that was down in Houston. They have a whole new team now, but down in Houston when it began, we were with the Peoria Pirates for a while. And then in 2000, I went up to BC Lions. I don't know if you saw that during the research. We was up there for a while. Then I came back and finished with Arena with Peoria. So
you did all that, but that's not going to be your career. You finally realized that's just not going to work out. When did you decide then that you wanted to go into teaching?
Teaching was, I was sitting after the first season of Arena, I was sitting at home pretty much, watching TV, getting ready to begin to continue my master's, finishing that master's up, and the phone rang. Chip Williams was on the other side of the call, my former football coach at New Bern, and he said, "You want to coach?" I said, "By all means, coach. Yeah, definitely I'll coach." So went down there, and that was the day, that was pre No Child Left Behind. So we went down there and they hired me half day as an administrative assistant type role, helping with discipline. And the other half of the day I was teaching out of subject math, and did that for 4 years. But the way I had to make the decision was my fourth year of teaching, that I was teaching all math courses at that time, I had to grow up, as I told you earlier. My principal told me, either you're going to choose the dream, because I was leaving to go play football mid-year, or, you know, you're going to choose a career. If we make you an assistant principal, you can't be leaving. You know, you affected 70 kids leaving at the mid-year. This time you're going to affect the whole school if you leave as assistant principal. Mm-hmm. So right then I had to make the choice. And I chose a career, and I'm so glad because look where we are today.
What made you choose that?
I think it was that little girl that I had, Frank. You know, I had to, you know, make sure that, you know, at any time you can get cut when you're in the league, when you're playing pro ball. But the career is pretty much a lot more secure. And they made me assistant principal. That was a nice boost in pay. And, you know, the rest was history. I just got bit by that bug of leading children. The first bug is when I first started teaching, when you have that aha moment with that child. They overcome a problem, or you teach them something that they didn't know, and they jump up in class. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Oh, God, I made it. That is infectious.
What was that like for you? Because kids will describe that, and they'll talk about the moment and what that did for them. But for a teacher who may not have had, didn't know that this is what they wanted to do, weren't necessarily thinking about this as a career, what's it like for you to suddenly see that in a child's eyes?
It's validation. It's validation. It's reinforcement. It's cognitive reinforcement when that happens. You know, we're creatures of feelings. You know, our feelings really drives our reactions. You know, those are largely unconscious. And for you to experience that as an adult, that I had an effect, I had an impact on a child, and that child has now jumped up and let me share in that joy of that moment. We call them aha moments. You just turn around and feel like you can do anything. You can truly help. You can truly change the world is the way you feel like. And I was bit then. Education was the key then. I wanted to do that on a larger scale, which led me into administration. If I can affect that one child in that one class as one teacher, imagine if you bring that approach and that love and that joy, and you can affect all 900 of those kids in that building to make a difference and to make a change in one's life.
So you did that, and there was 4 years at New Bern, right? And then you were offered assistant principal position at Tucker Creek Middle School, right?
Yes, sir.
So what was that like at middle school, and how is that different?
Oh, middle school. Oh, God. Middle schoolers want all the freedom with no responsibility. That's how I sum it up. I love them all. They're still, especially the sixth graders, they still look like the little babies. They look like the little cute, want to pinch their cheek little babies in sixth grade. But, Lord, when they turn to seventh grade, something happens. And then eighth grade, they're grown. They think they know it all. You can't tell them nothing at that time. So that big wide of range of personalities made middle school very interesting. I will tell you, there was not the same day. A day never went by without something big happening in middle school. But it was very rewarding. If you're going to make change in a child's life, especially academic and socially, that is the time to do it before their personality is cemented, if you're going to make a change in their life. But middle school was great. I mean, it was awesome.
You talked about the fact that what bit you, what got you, was the fact that you could make a difference in a child's life. And if you could do it as a teacher, reaching a few kids, think about what you can do building-wide if you're the principal or assistant principal. But how is it different? How is being an administrator different than being a teacher?
The teachers, being an administrator, you really have to lead by example. You have to inspire. Now, sometimes administrators can just get by being a manager, having a managerial approach. But if you can inspire a teacher, okay, and then that teacher can in turn use that same theme and inspire a child, then half of your battle is won with the mastery of the objective. You know, I always strive across the state and I say, can do, will do. And people think it's just a commercial. Oh, that's too simple. No, it is. It is not chess. It's checkers. The teaching game of what we do, our profession, is simply put like this, right? Can-do is your ability to deploy the objectives, you know, the cognitive piece of approach, the academic piece of approach. You knowing the standards and able to use a curriculum to enhance the education environment so they remember the objectives and mastery. The will-do is, have you built the relationship and do you have the classroom culture that gets them children to want to participate, to want to do the work, to turn the work in? You know, a lot of kids will do anything for you as the adult that they won't do for themselves. So that's what you call classroom culture. So if you have those two in place, you can teach anybody. You can change lives as long as those two are in place. So we're here to inspire. And as from a principal, if you can inspire the students and the teachers, then you have invested in your human capital, and the results will take care of themselves.
In 2008, you moved, and I guess you described the difference then between the managerial approach and the leadership approach, which has maybe a greater chance of inspiring that kind of culture, mm-hmm. because you're taking that approach. So then in 2008, you moved to Havelock Middle School, right? Yep. And you were there for 7 years. Talk about what discipline was like at Havelock when you arrived.
Oh, when I first got there, the principal had pretty much got into it with a student outside. Well, I'm not going to blame the principal. The student was wrong for that. Put his hands on the principal when he shouldn't have. And, you know, there was a lot of, I would say, fights before I got there. First year I got there, we had a few, but we were able to change the culture. We invested in culture when we got to Havelock Middle School. And they had a mentality of the forgotten ones because, again, that school that I was at originally, Tucker Creek, was the newer school. In the city of Havelock. So we actually got there and focused on culture and got things turned around real good. My fourth year there, they changed the curriculum on us. They changed the standards, switched them all up around at the state level, but didn't give us the standards until November. So we were teaching blindly for like 4 months prior to us getting our act together. And we had the lowest scores, you know, that I could ever remember. But within 3 years, we increased those scores by 20 points per year.
How'd you do that?
Simply investing in children, what I just told you before, can do, will do.
But what does it mean on the ground? What does it look like? Again, the culture, there were a lot of fights. There were some students who clearly felt left out. And they got it, and everybody knew who they were, and that culture was sort of what you walked into. How do you change that mindset? What do you say to people, and how does it look different to you than it did when you walked in?
We rebranded. We rebranded our school. We rebranded our school. We adjusted the mascot. We came up with this mantra. It was called One Vision, One School. No, I'm sorry. One Vision, One Mission, One Soul. One Vision, One School, One Squad was HJ. We'll get into that. But we followed that mantra every time. One Vision, One Mission, One Soul. We put it on bumper stickers. We put it all over the hallways. The kids said it every day. After my announcements, we played a trick on the teachers. I would say, always at Havelock Middle, we are One Vision, One Mission. And the deal with the kids was, they screamed One Soul, and they made the teachers jump the first 3 weeks every time they did it. That was our joke on the teachers. I mean, that was the relationship building with my kids. Like, I got y'all back if y'all do this. So the teachers would jump, Lord Jesus, what is wrong with y'all? So it was the funniest thing, but those kids believed in that.
Yeah.
And it was us against the world mentality, and they wanted to outperform their affluent counterparts across the base. And they did it.
Hmm.
We even closed the achievement gap my last 2 years there. That's unheard of.
After the big drop with the shift in curriculum.
Yes, but like this, that big drop, we were down in the 20s. By the time I left and went to H.J. McDonald, we were 60s and 70s. Those kids believed in what we were doing. Those teachers believed in the process. They dug deep in the learning focus. That was our platform that we used to bring it all together. And the cultural thing that we have, and we had a club program that was just great, making them keep a 75 and above in every class so they can participate in clubs. So that's another thing we did as well.
You just mentioned H.J. McDonald, another middle school. That's where you went next, and you were there for 2 years, 2015 to 2017. And that was a period of redistricting. So talk about how that redistricting affected the school, H.J. McDonald.
Yeah, we went to what you call neighborhood schools at that time. That was under the previous superintendent, and what they did was they drew the lines based on, you know, where you lived at, and then they assigned schools based in the area of where you were going. But that approach actually resulted in four of the projects, all right, or four of the low-income areas being placed into one school, which was H.J. McDonald. Then they called me at Havelock Middle right after my father died. And asked me, would I go to H.J. McDonald? I had so much success at Havelock Middle, it was almost like, okay, can you duplicate this on a larger scale? And then, you know, when I got there, I was like, whoa. So when I saw what saw what was put in, I said, now how did we let this happen? But I had one thing that they didn't realize I had going for us when I got to H.J. McDonald. I was from where they were from. You see what I'm saying? I knew the parents. I knew the grandparents. You know, so I wasn't intimidated by it being four projects or four low socioeconomic neighborhoods being in the same ones. I knew those children. So when we got in there, we developed the One Vision, One School, One Squad. You had to make it hip, you know, because you got to think about where you're at. So you had to make it hip, something that a child would get behind, something that they could be proud of. We printed shirts. We did banners. It was everywhere. You would have thought we were at high school when you first got to New Bern. We made so much noise in regards to H.J. McDonald. But I did that to give those babies an identity. They had been thrown into one school altogether and was asked to make it work.
We talked about that identity, and, you know, you refer to them as our babies. You say, I know the parents, I know the kids. So talk a little bit about the importance of making the school a community and making that community feel like an extension of the family.
Once you get the village concept embedded to the conscience of a school, you've won. Once they realize that it's all of us in it together and we cannot excel, we're only as strong as our weakest link or the lowest score, that's when you get people, you get children helping children, and you remove the teacher. The teacher becomes a facilitator. That's how you invoke change. That's how you create a culture within your building that just exudes success. As case in point, you can come to a building. It's something about, I'll give you a correlation, it's something about when you add paint to the inside of a building, where the students feel pride, a sense of pride of their building and what they walk to and they interact with every day. It's amazing how when the new paint hit, you rarely see graffiti on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Now, in the older schools where it hasn't been painted and it looks bad, then kids tend to treat it bad, and they'll put graffiti on the wall. But if you walk through West Craven High School right now, you won't see a drop of graffiti on the walls at all. Because they love their school. This is their school. You're not going to mess up what you have, right. What you want. Remember that investment? Once you invest in something, it's a different approach because you've given a piece of you to make it happen.
But talk about families, too, an investment of families. I know I did some teaching for a while, and I heard a lot from people about how, you know, families, especially poorer families, they're just not as involved with their kids, and that's the problem. That was not my experience, but our experience at our school in particular was that we really created an inviting atmosphere. Parents wanted to show up at our school, and I wonder what you can say about that, about bringing whole families into this picture.
Oh, that's definitely a key. Right now, where I'm at, we service 485 square miles. We are made up of 13 to 15 different township hubs up north. You would call them boroughs out here in the western end. And the only time it truly comes together is at school. So we are the identity. West Craven High School, the Eagles, is the mechanism that brings all the families together. But I'm going to go a step further. We are a prideful community. We went through Hurricane Florence, you know, where our sister school was out of school 40 days. We were out of school 25 days. But we fed the community. We were the hub for feeding the community, getting resources to the community. Anytime something happens, this school is in full gear for the community. So when we call out, the community reciprocates. And we are one big family out here because we're out here by ourselves. We're out here in the country. We're in the rural. We got to take care of ourselves. But there is a sense of family here. Because this is where it all comes together. In high school, a lot of times it's hard to get parent support within the building because, you know, they know we got them. They know we're going to feed their children. We take care of their kids. We're very active in the community. But when we call on them, they come. I can say that. They come.
Yeah, so when you say we were feeding them during Florence, we were the center. That we included families, students, and staff?
Oh, yes. Schools. I mean, this school was the epicenter. I mean, we did three different giveaways and help where we gave out hygiene, cleaning materials, food, any type of resource that you would need to rebuild. Because, you know, the Neuse River came over its banks and just wiped us out, Frank. I mean, it was a tough time during Hurricane Florence, and it took all of us working together to overcome that. We even opened our building, West Craven High School. We slid all the high schoolers over to one side of the building, and we brought the James W. Smith little babies, kindergarten through fifth grade, into a high school so they can have somewhere to go to school. That's an illustration and a true testament of how close-knit the West Side is. We take care of our own because we're out here all by ourselves. And we brought them in, and we made it work. You had little kindergartens. I got this picture I'm going to have to send to you after this interview, but it's the most beautiful picture. This 6'5" African-American football player, okay, he was a junior then. Big boy, braids going all down his head. You'd scare you to death if you saw him on the street. He's walking with this little fifth grader, little Caucasian, blue-eyed, blonde, little, and they're walking down the hallway together. And that backstory is the little girl was scared to go to class because she was afraid of all the big people. You know, you're in a school full of high schoolers, you're a little kindergarten. But as long as her friend was around, as long as he walked her, she was the bravest thing in the world because nobody was going to touch it because she was with her friend. And that is a testament of what we are right here at West Craven High School. We are all one. We're one eagle. We love each other and we take care of each other.
And you've been at West Craven since 2018. What was the condition? What condition was West Craven in academically? And I guess in terms of discipline when you got there?
It's So my first year here, buddy, we had 35 fights. Now, I'm going to go ahead and I got to own that one because it shocked me. I never knew that you could have that many altercations in one school year. So we definitely focused on discipline when we first got here, discipline and expectations, high expectations, and really in what we call accountability. Some people call it discipline, but it's truly you're accountable for your behaviors. West Craven was pretty much, you know, before I got here, we were always in third place. You have New Bern High, you have Havelock, and when it comes to accountability and, you know, the EOC results and the report card grades, we were always third place behind the other two. And that just gave us a little chip on our shoulder out here. And I tried to encapsulate that when I got here. It's like, we're sick of being third place. We want to be the best. When you send your children to a school, you expect it to be the best. So that's what we changed the vision to, and that's what we pretty much charged ourselves with. But first we had to get control of the environment, you know, when I first got here. So we instituted some things, got it all turned around. A year ago, we had one of, you know, the highest scores ever attained in biology here at West Craven. That's just a testament to the hard work and the change that we tried to instill here.
Well, let's talk about some of the technical details and maybe ways in which people don't even think about school and administration. But, you know, like a lot of public schools across the state, you have students who are facing food insecurity. And I know West Craven has attracted notice for its work in addressing student hunger. Talk about your Second Chance Breakfast program.
Yes, we have, when we first got here, we had breakfast in the morning, and we only had 40 people eating. Okay, we start school at 7:30, so common sense will tell you something's wrong with that timetable there. Kids getting here, getting off the bus at 6:30 or 6:45, if they just woke up, maybe they're not so hungry. So what we did was we simply moved breakfast from in the morning to make it a part of the school day and moved it till after first tier. Now, we created a breakfast break. Have you ever seen Saved by the Bell?
Oh, yeah.
That's what our school looks like during powwow and during breakfast break. You got kids like Zach and them just walking around everywhere. You never saw them turkeys go to class. I mean, them jokers was always in the hallway. And that's pretty much what we are. That's what it looks like. But we do that for the socio-emotional piece of our culture of what we do. It's a reason why there's tables in restaurants, because that's when we have our best conversations. That's when we really talk a lot. So we use that to allow for our kids to have that time. Plus, remember, we service 485 square miles. So me and you are friends. You may stay in Dover, and I might stay in Fairfield Harbor. That is an hour and a half drive, so I can see you as my best friend, Frank. So the only time I get to see you is at school. So we use that. So we give them the time while they're eating, to commiserate and to conversate and to talk and this and that. And our breakfast participation went up 551% after the first year.
Wow. Wow. So you went from like 40 kids to 500 kids eating breakfast.
Yes, sir. It was at 617 to be exact. Yep.
Wow. Well, and there's a lockstep correlation between, you know, food and nutrition and performance in school, right?
Exactly. That's when we really started to see a jump in performance. And I use this correlation, this example as, we all know when you start smelling the food, you can be in worship, you can be at work, you can be doing this and that, but something about lunchtime, we keep looking at the clock, ain't it? When 12 o'clock hit, you at the station right now, when it's your lunchtime, 10 minutes before, your body kicks in and you start looking at that time. You start looking at the time, which means you're not learning. You see what I'm saying? So we erase that from the equation. We go ahead and feed them breakfast after first period, then they only have two more periods before their lunch, and then our kids get an hour lunch. You know, we got accolades across the state about this, but our children get an hour lunch. Yeah. If they keep a 75 and above in their classes, they get an hour lunch.
But you do that, again, this has been the problem, because as you said earlier, you said something like, well, if I see 40 kids participating and I see 7 o'clock in the morning or 7:40 or whatever when they're arriving, I know something's wrong with that schedule.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of administrators say, yeah, I know something's wrong with the schedule. What can I do? That's when the bus gets here. You did something. So let's talk about how you had to manage the logistics, because it's not just noticing and it's not just the intention to change. You have to say, what do I do about all those kids milling around, going to a table instead of a classroom in the middle of the day? How do you manage the logistics of breaking the schedule that way? And I'll get to lunch in a minute, but let's just do breakfast.
Yeah, breakfast, when we first did it, you have to, because we give the kids 15 minutes, because you can't, you know, because you got to keep that 90 minutes of instruction. We didn't want to upset that academically. So what we did was we took the Salix bar, we took the salad bar out of the school that was largely being unused, and we put them as I would say a variation of what we would call kiosks today.
Mm-hmm.
And we set them up in different hallways so we can break down the lines. You see, everybody can't get through the cafeteria line in 15 minutes. You know, you can't
right.
get that many kids through, so we separated them. So if you didn't want a hot meal and you just wanted a snack, Pop-Tarts or fruit or this and that, you can go to the other part of the school to get that. It's almost like I equate it to the food court in the mall.
Right.
You know, you break up those lines. So we got very creative. We got innovative when we did that. And that assisted in getting the line straight. Now, funny thing is, once an innovative project hit, it seems like other people gets behind you. So our district saw us carrying these salad bars down the hallway. It's like, oh, my God, we got to do something about this, Mr. Wallace. This is just different. So they bought us kiosks. And when they bought us kiosks, now we have a fully functioning power hour and breakfast where the kids can now break up. It stays hot, and now we have multiple lines where we can get them all through.
And you don't have chaos. It's not like you can't get them back into the classroom after that. Not only that, the scores all went up. You said you went, you know, you've got record numbers in biology, and I'm sure more courses are on the way. So tell me more. Tell about the lunch program, because that kiosk system, I think, is still in place for lunches. Am I right?
It is. It's still in place for lunch, and it's a godsend now that we're in COVID when the babies come back. You know, we have the kiosk right there, whereas, you know, it's already packaged meals. So we're already beat that curve in preparing for COVID. But Power Hour was a program that we put in to, number one, external motivator to trigger extrinsic motivation in all students. And what we do is, if you have a 75 and above in your classes, you get to enjoy the luxury of having an hour lunch, which you can talk to your friends, you can see the counselor, you can go lay down in the library, you can go outside and participate in intramurals. There's so many things that goes on. The clubs are offered during that time, National Honor Society, National Technology Society. And what that does to kids is, you have to keep that 75 and above to be eligible to attend your club meetings, to be eligible to, you know, get that hour lunch. And that had an increase on our kids doing their work and submitting their assignments. But it's the most beautiful thing, because, you know, once you take care of that external motivator and it triggers intrinsic motivation, the rest takes care of itself. They come into a routine. But this is so
incredible, because it seems like such a tiny thing. It's critical for anybody who's ever taught or tried to administer a school. The school bus schedule drives everything, does it not? That's it. And then you start drawing in your curriculum after you know when the buses are going to arrive. But so many people feel tied to that, like they can't do anything else. And what you said is, okay, we're going to rejigger this whole schedule to make it all fit, and you can have the buses arrive whenever you want. A little bit of creativity. It turns out that you've improved everything.
That's right. We knocked two birds out with one stone. The kids got to sleep 10 to 15 minutes later, too.
Ooh.
You know, so the students love that. They got to sleep in a little bit more once we changed the bus schedule. And all the buses arrive like 10 to 15. You don't have to feed them in the morning.
Yeah.
So it's 10 to 15 minutes. They arrive here to get off the bus. The bell's ringing and going right on the class.
Well, let's talk about how things have changed now over the past several months. During COVID, of course, many school districts have set up meal distribution hubs for families who rely on those school breakfasts. What's been going on at West Craven?
Right now, we are a CEP school, so our kids can eat free if they come on out and get it. But right now, we're Plan C, the kids are, you know, home digital, but they can come to the school and get food if they need it. And our doors are open from 11 to 1. If there's a hub closer to them, they can go to that hub and get their food, and we still get credit for it here. As far as our cafeteria participation.
What have you been seeing in terms of participation?
You know, today is the first day, so I'm very shocked that we've had as many come by today on the first day than we would normally have. Remember, we're an hour and a half away from some of our children.
Right.
So we do understand that they're going to go to the elementary school that's in their area to go get it. But I think kids are just coming out to see their teacher. You'll be amazed that the state just doesn't know the relationship between a student and a teacher.
Yeah.
The kids want to see their teachers.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing. You would think high schoolers don't care. Oh, they care.
Mm-hmm.
They care. And some of them come out here that's their way in the building. They can't come in the building other than that. But that's their way to get in the building and to get a bag lunch, and just to say hi to the front office, or just to say hi to their teacher, just to see their face one more time before they leave. So I think that's what's driving our participation today.
Well, apparently you understood that, which is why you made it a point to see every graduating senior last year. Talk about that decision and how that worked out.
Yeah, that was a big one. The county purchased the signs, and when we got the signs, a lot of people just say they were going to put them in their yard. And I was like, no, we got to make this special because we weren't sure if they were going to have graduation in the first place. So we came up with the idea that we would split up and make sure a caravan or parade would go to each and every child's home. And as we presented the signs, we gave them the elevator speeches, let this sign serve as a bridge. Every time you come in and out your house, that West Craven High School would get you across the traditional stage. So every time you leave, you know, you'll see that sign. And then we made sure their family was there when we brought the sign. So it was like a mini graduation at their house is what we did. We were in full regalia, cap, gown, the whole nine. And then we did that. What a lot of people don't know is just last week or 2 weeks ago, over a six-day period, we performed that individual graduation for every last one of our graduates to fulfill that promise we made back in May.
Wow.
Right, and it took us 6 days to do it.
What does that mean? How did you do that? I mean, did you go to each house? And actually, how is that different than what you did at the end of the year?
The first plan was to go to their house until we had 100-plus temperatures during that week. So we had to bring it inside. So we had the kids sign up for a 15-minute time slot. They brought their guests, that we got into the auditorium, we social distanced, and they got pomp and circumstance, they got all the speeches, they got the Board of Education, they got the conferring of their tassels, they received their diploma, anything that we could put in that ceremony to make sure that we fulfilled the promise, that life, that moment in time that we all appreciate is graduation. Everybody has that on their wall at Mama House.
Wow. So we can certainly see how the coronavirus is changing everything in education and of course, making things difficult, especially in your part of the state. I know lack of internet access has challenged some of your students. What are you doing about that?
We enlisted and partnered with the churches across our area. So we have the little internet hubs going on where kids can go and access internet via the fire departments or the churches that are on our list. And that's working very, very good. That's another example of us coming together. But also we have come up with an innovative thing with our iPads. All our kids have iPads, but without internet, they do no good. So what we've done is we've got jump drives that we record the lessons on the jump drives, and the kids just come and swap them out per week. They bring one jump drive back and get the next week's lesson while they're leaving the other jump drive so we can record the next week's lesson. So they always get to see their teacher. That's how you get around the internet gap that we have.
Wow, that sounds like one of the lessons. What are some of the other lessons you learned just from last spring that you're bringing forward now this fall?
Seat time does not equal mastery. And that's on a teacher level. We almost killed them babies last year when we first got out for COVID. Our teachers did not know digital learning. We didn't understand it. We left on a Friday, and then we came back Monday. We were digital learning. We had no time to prepare. We had nothing. You know, my teachers were not ready for this. So guess what they did? They had the kids on Zoom for 90 minutes doing what they would normally do in school, not realizing that there's four classes of that the kids have to do. So now we've cut that in half. Now we have 40 minutes of synchronous instruction, and the rest is allowing the students to massage information and to work on the information. But that was a big time. Seat time does not equal mastery is what I learned. So I had to pull my teachers back. I almost killed my students last year.
Well, so obviously you're learning as you go, and you make those adjustments with great agility. So much of your approach and so much of your success is built on community building, and that means people being together. And obviously, you're trying to recreate that the best you can. But are you concerned now that without that kind of bond that one gets by being together, that you might lose some of that this year?
That is the biggest fear when you're heavy, you know, when you rely on culture so much as we do. So we try to supplement that with communication. Even though we can't be together physically, we have so many other modalities. You know, I meet with every class every other week so they can see the administrator's face via Zoom. We're working on a way to recreate Power Hour where the kids for lunch, where I'll host it, where the kids can go into breakout rooms and talk to each other or talk to their friends that they usually would talk to. So we're working on that. We also are having little things that we can do between 25 and under. You know, the governor's order is if you're outside, you can't have a 25. So we're knowing that, and to get that personal touch, that social, you know, to reinforce that social, emotional community type tie, we try to attend things that has no more than 25 people in the community just to stay visible. So we're trying to find ways around it, but it's tough. It's tough when you can't touch the baby.
You are not the only school administrator in your family. Your wife is a principal. Do you two share trade secrets?
Yes, we do. I think on her side, it's more of a competition. You know, she was Teacher of the Year for the county back, I think, in 2011, 2012, and she really rubbed it in. So when I won it for the whole state, you know, I reciprocated. And ever since then, she's been trying to get me. So, but she's very, 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 very in tune with her school, just happy we do share stories when we get home. One strange thing, we're supposed to finish our doctorates at the same time. So we're thinking in May of this of next year that we're going to be walking across the stage at the same time, me at East Carolina and her at Liberty. And we're definitely looking forward to that.
You thinking of trying to beat her by any chance?
Maybe I think I'll finish before she will. I think I'll finish before she will, but I wouldn't tell her that. I'm going to wait for graduation day and be like, oh, we finished at the same time. Baby.
And your daughter attended your alma mater, East Carolina, right?
She did. East Carolina, she sure did. We all came to there. We're all Pirates. So. And she's still in Greenville right now.
Tabari Wallace, principal of West Craven High School in Vanceboro, North Carolina, 2018 Principal of the Year. What a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you so much for taking out time out of what is the busiest day of the year. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Frank. Most appreciate it.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.